This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll chat with one of the great, young, and dynamic violinists on the scene today, Augustin Haderlich. Born of German parents in a small Italian town, he is now firmly established here in the U.S. as an American citizen. He studied his instrument in sporadic episodes due to the family's living location, survived a horrible burn accident at the age of 15, almost robbing him of his ability, a part of his life he chooses not to discuss, then started to concertize with major orchestras and major venues, won a gold medal at the 2006 International Violin Competition in Indianapolis, and his career took off. Many awards and accolades have followed, including an Avery Fisher Career Grant and a Grammy Award for his recording with the Seattle Symphony. His most recent release on the Warner Classics label are the 24 Caprices for Solo Violin by Niccolo Paganini, works he has often played in his career as concert encores. You're listening to him perform the Caprices No. 5 in A minor, followed by the No. 6 in G minor. Turning 34 in 2 weeks, his musical maturity, tone, and approach have the critics comparing him to the great violinists of that instrument's golden age. He takes every day as another chance to make great music. I spoke with Augustin Haderlich in New York City a few months back. Thank you.
Very happy to be here today with violinist Augustine Herrlich. Well, we'll start with the new recording. Congratulations on the new recording of the Paganini Caprices. A few questions right off of that. You are not alone in this over the many, many, many decades since they've been composed, but you've used some of these over your years as encores. So the first question is, why choose one of these? It might be obvious, but why? And how do you know which one to play after which concert? How do you sort that all out as far as using these pieces as encores?
So usually there was one caprice that for a couple of months I would have prepared as an encore whenever it felt right after the piece and whenever I felt right when I walked on stage. Actually, once, it's not too long ago, I got a little bit, peeved at a conductor who announced to the audience himself before the concert started that I would be playing a Paganini Caprice as an encore. Because actually it should be when I walk back on and there's a lot of applause after a concerto, that if it feels right to me, because sometimes you have to actually feel great to play these pieces because they're really, really difficult. There's also certain concertos after which they wouldn't fit. And that is another consideration, that there are certain caprices that, for example, maybe after a classic concerto like Mozart or Beethoven, some caprices are better because they're a little bit more lighter, not too romantic. Paganini's style is right there in the transition between classical and romantic style. It's very Rossini-like, so pretty classical, but sometimes already gets very...
So actually, sometimes the choice of which one is simply the one you've got in your head right at that time and right at the fingers. I mean, this set that he wrote, I mean, it is not analogous directly, but you could look at it kind of like the Bach cello suites for a cellist, and that violinists have to surmount these at some point in their career. You've never, or have you ever, performed them as some violinists do, as an entity, as an evening?
Altogether, no. And I actually don't think I will, because I always thought it's not only very hard on the violinist, it's also very hard on the audience, actually. And I don't think that they're meant, that they're intended to be heard together. Just that Paganini had composed these over many years, so not really as a set. And eventually people kept, pressuring him to publish something. And so he published these 24 caprices, but I think he took ideas and pieces that he had written for himself over a long period of time and sort of created the set. But it wouldn't be something that he would walk out on stage and play 24 caprices. His concerts were very different, so he would often perform a piece and then a singer would perform a Mozart aria, and then he would perform a piece again and more like that. And I think he also, the effect of them is strongest when you hear them in sort of small doses, where you're really blown away by the...
Because, I mean, you took a few years to sort of come to the recording with these too. It's not like you went and said, I'm doing, you know. So, I mean, how do you view them as a set in light of a career as a violinist? What purpose do they serve? I mean, when I ask cellists that, they have a very definite, this is what the Bach suites mean to me. Mm-hmm. Some of them it's Bible. Some of it's they wake up every morning and their first, the fingers hit the fingerboard and they're playing Bach cello suites. Uh-huh. I mean, how do you view these caprices as a totality of what Paganini left for you as a world-class violinist?
It's certainly not the first thing I play when I get up. I'll tell you that. So, well, to me, I grew up in Italy, where Paganini is really considered to be one of the great composers, one of the great Italian composers, certainly of the 19th century. And I was always surprised that outside of Italy, he's regarded sort of less highly. Somebody who wrote Berlin etudes, you know, people think of these as etudes, when they're really, I think, much more than that. And the musical content of them is, yeah, it's very important. There's a lot of beautiful music there, a lot of beauty, a lot of humor. And I thought it was important in this recording that for that to come out. A lot of caprices make me smile when I think of the music. I'm like, this is really funny, or it's really, really humorous, really very beautiful. There's number 4, number 6. There's some caprices that are very, very emotional. The problem is just you have to get past these technical obstacles to get to the music. And it takes a very long time, and it's a lot of work to practice them. And so because of that, they can sometimes feel like a chore to violinists to, you know, have to put in all this work. One thought I had when I was preparing for this recording is that when you hear a sound recording of them, you don't really get this showy aspect so much. You don't get the visual show of seeing the violinist start up and down the strings and do all these fancy bowings, and you're hearing only the music. So actually the musical message becomes even more important, and it's so important that, you know, they played with character and expression, and actually that should be important anyway, but in a concert there's this additional layer that you're impressing people because they're also seeing it. Yeah,
which is interesting. So it'd be interesting to get Paganini's take, because he considered himself, you know, he was a guitarist and a violinist, he considered himself a very accomplished musician and serious musician, yet he did have the visual aspect which caused the sensation when he played. So it'd be interesting to see if he would like the fact that the caprices were being taken out purely musical realm through a recording. It'd be interesting to get his take on that, you know, just to divorce them from the visual.
Well, I think that as compositions, these are pretty ambitious and very, very skillfully composed, and there's a lot of actually amazing things that happen in them that, I don't know, you can show that. One thing that's very fascinating is how other composers reacted to this music, and not just to the spectacle of a song Paganini performed, but, you know, Schumann transcribed 12 of these caprices for solo piano, and they're very beautiful transcriptions, and he clearly like spent a lot of time looking at them. Then, of course, there's Liszt. That's maybe a showier take on it. He was more, I think, fascinated by Paganini as a showman presenting himself like this. And so he did, you know, a similar thing on the piano. But I think that this kind of, you know, carnival aspect of Paganini's performances was also a way to get people into the hall in the first place. You do whatever it takes to get the audience in. But he actually presented the programs were actually quite tasteful, but they were entertaining, and, you know, it was a lot of fireworks. But
and he was breaking ground as a solo performer that people would pay a ticket to and come and see some one man on stage. I mean, he was breaking ground in that way. Turning once again to my guest, violinist Augustin Hadelik's new recording on the Warner Classics label of the 24 Caprices of Paganini, here's the final and best known caprice, the Caprice number 24 in A minor, which has inspired many a composer, 53 at last count, to set it to variations including names like Liszt, Brahms, Rachmaninoff, and Ludoslavsky. Thank you. You mentioned I grew up in Italy. You grew up in a family of amateur musician parents, musical siblings, but you had a very unconventional path of learning the violin when you were young. It's not like you were, you know, to the conservatory, the teacher chained in the, you know, it's you learned the violin in a very interesting way, which I think our listeners might be fascinated by, because it was kind of on your own, fits and starts, or lesson here, lesson. I mean, it was a way to sort of patch quilt a way of learning the violin. So talk about it just a bit.
Well, my first teacher was my father, who was an amateur cellist, right. So actually not a violinist. But his mother had been a violin teacher, so he did have a bit of some knowledge of how to start the violin. And then he took me to other teachers when I was about 7, because he wasn't sure what to do next. And the place where we lived in Italy, there actually were no good teachers nearby. And so that's why he started traveling with me. And then there were different people I studied with, the violinist Uto Ughi, for example, Christoph Poppen, a lot of people who would vacation in Italy that we found somehow. So Christoph Poppen, he had a quartet at the time. And this is a, you know, important German teacher who spent a lot of time in Italy rehearsing with his quartet, and we tracked him down, and, you know, then he was teaching me. Norbert Breining from the Amadeus Quartet was another one. And there were some other teachers too. I actually had some of the best teachers, I think, that were around in Europe. The teaching God was incredible, but I didn't get it every week. So I would get a few lessons from them and then not see them for a very long time. So then I was at home trying to do the things. This is something, actually, when people who have weekly lessons their whole life, and then they go to conservatory, have weekly lessons again, and then they're finally graduated. For the first time, they actually have to start doing what their teachers told them, because for the first time, they ask themselves, what am I going to do now? And then they think back to everything that the teachers told them and start applying it, when you don't rely on someone telling you every week. So I had this experience quite early on that I was playing and thinking, well, what should I do? And then I was thinking back, well, you know, this guy said that, and this teacher said that, and maybe I should try this. And I also realized early on that they were contradicting each other completely all the time. They were never saying the same thing. And I realized that they're all of them were somewhat right. And that's was interesting.
But that's a young age and a young time on the instrument to have to apply a lot of self-discipline, which you did, right? I mean, you had to say, I'm going to practice. It's kind of commendable that you were able to say, no, I'm going to do this. And it's not because I have a lesson next week. It's because I have a lesson in 3 months and I'm going to make progress on this instrument.
Well, I had quite a lot of concerts early on. So I was starting when I was 9, 10 years old, I was starting to play concerts. And that, of course, is always very motivating because you have to get ready. But, you know, at the time, of course, my parents were encouraging, would remind me, you know, well, you know, maybe you should start practicing now and keeping time a little bit. And that is important because there are always days when you kind of don't feel like it. Right. I mean, that actually happens to me now as an adult too. Practicing is really not fun. It can be fun when you have a breakthrough, you know, something that was really hard suddenly is easier, or you've discovered something, then suddenly it's fun. But what's fun to me now is when I'm actually performing or when I'm playing with other people and not when I'm doing the work myself. So I think that to develop that self-discipline, that's something that, you know, smaller children, they kind of don't think about it. They don't think of it as work. And then at some point you start thinking of it at work, then it's really hard. And then you learn how to get up and do it and, you know, put in the work. So there was definitely a time in my childhood when I was working less.
Yeah, the work kind of overtakes the fun aspect of it as the kids grow up. Here's my guest, Augustine Hadelich, with pianist Joyce Yang from a recital recording on the AVI label of music by Andre Previn, Georgi Kurtag, Cesar Franck, and Robert Schumann. This is the final movement, Lebhaft, from Schumann's Violin Sonata No. 1 in A minor, Opus 105. Thank you. two other things about your career which are interesting. You know the violinist Rachel Barton Pine, correct?
Okay.
Both of you sustained injuries in your teens, and if people know the details, they can check it out on a website about you. But because of that, it forced you to say, not only am I going to be a musician, but the violin is going to be my path back. And it focused your mind, and I know with her, so I know I've known her very well since she was a little girl, actually. I'm just wondering, today, I mean, that's half a lifetime away for you now, but today, that mindset, that determination, which is unique because of that incident, not that you ever want it to happen again, how does that stay with you? I mean, it has to shade your career a little bit differently than if something like that hadn't happened in your career. And just that determination that the violin would be the way you were going to continue. I'm just curious.
Yeah. I don't know. That's hard to say because I don't really know what it would have been like otherwise. I've met a lot of incredibly determined musicians who like just know exactly what they want, who never had anything like this happen to them. So I think at some point everyone has times when they're kind of searching and they're not sure, and then somehow they think, no, I want to do this. And one thing that really changed, and certainly, yes, I realized that music was very important to me after this accident. But I would also say there were many other events that also strengthened that. For example, that when I started playing a lot of chamber music, that before that, I thought I knew everything. And I thought, well, you know, I thought I knew what music was. But actually, everything changed. My eyes were open to a lot of other things. It became more fun. It was very inspiring to work with other people. And that also, yeah, changed my whole outlook on music and made me maybe more convinced that that's what I wanted to do.
I guess what I'm saying, over the years, 13 years of this program, I had a lot of young artists, you know, young instrumentalists especially. And if there's a point in the career where that might have been taken away from them, they never had that. You know, it's just one long continuous line of growth, 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 getting better, better, better. And I guess the idea that it could have been taken away.
Mm-hmm. It's a very hard thing to wrap your mind around, that you realize you can't do this forever. So I know now, because I already had that happen once, that at some point I won't play the violin anymore, and I'm actually okay with that. But many people I know are not. It's very, very difficult to stop. It's very scary, the thought to stop. But there is more to life than your work. And actually, you can also spend, I also realized back then, you can spend time with music even when you're not playing. And so, but I feel very lucky that I get to do what I do, because it's a lot of fun.
One other, I say this because I respect your opinion on it, one other little dichotomy about your career is you've talked about competitions, and believe me, I'm on the page with you here, but that they can be, you know, they pit musician against musician, where musicians should be working together. However, it was a competition in 2006 that really launched your name out there, which did a lot of benefit for your career, gave you a lot of benefits. I'm just curious how you look at it. I mean, now you're reaching an age now, you're early 30s, where you, because of your stature, because of your career and how it's going, you're going to have younger instrumentalists, younger violinists who might be looking to you. What do you say about the whole competition thing? It did benefit you, yet your reasoning and your stance on competitions is very much in step with many instrumentalists in your age group. It's just like they're not healthy on the whole. I'm just curious.
Well, there often is no way around it, because if you're trying to get your name out there and gain that kind of experience, you know, it's very difficult to be given a first chance when you're one of many, 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 many violinists. I mean, there's more than ever. And it used to be many years ago, you know, for example, there were so few people who could play one of the difficult concertos, you know, in tune, or like there was really, really easy ways to kind of tell people apart. That's not really true anymore. So it's just a question of taste often. And so it's very hard to kind of get started. And a competition can be a good way just to get a bit of a start, get your name out there, get the ball rolling. There are people who manage without, actually. And that's wonderful. In my case, I did really need it, because at the time I didn't have so much going on. I was playing some concerts, but this Indianapolis competition opened a lot of doors, because a lot of people, presenters, orchestras, people were watching as it happened, were hearing me for the first time, and then gave me a chance. And the real competition, so it's definitely something that most people who want to have a solo career kind of probably have to do. They have to win some prizes, they have to get the ball rolling. What's important is to realize, though, that the winning competition isn't the main point of it, and that actually the real competition happens after the competition. Because in the case of Indianapolis, a lot of smaller orchestras hired me to perform with them, and it was great because I got all this experience performing a lot of the repertoire. That goes on for a couple of years, but then the test is, do these places hire you back a second time? Do they want you to come back? When that happens, if every place you go to hires you back, then sooner or later you get quite busy. But that's the only way that it keeps going. And the orchestra hires you back. Maybe you worked with a guest conductor. That guest conductor takes you to another orchestra or to his orchestra. You know, stuff like that happens. And it's extremely slow. And I was actually very impatient at the time. I was like, why am I not playing? Yeah. And it was very slow also in Europe because, there are a lot of competitions out there nowadays. And they pay a little bit less attention to Indianapolis. But gradually, things were happening more and more. And I would occasionally get some crazy opportunity, somebody canceled somewhere and I could fill in on short notice. But it's kind of a long process, and every single concert, even the ones that are in the smallest, most remote place, actually somehow contributes to that. In fact, actually, sometimes you don't know who's going to show up. Sometimes someone really important, I mean, in the music world suddenly shows up in the smallest recital, you know, that I played all year. It can happen. So you actually should treat every concert with that as though it was the most important thing.
Well, and with technology now, anyone could be taking that concert and putting it up on a platform on the web. That's another question.
Yeah.
But still, you never know who's out there is the point. My guest won a Grammy Award for a recording, one of two he made, with the Seattle Symphony, led by their music director and past Cadenza guest Ludovic Morlot, of music of the Frenchman Henri Dutilleux. Here's the final section of the Grammy Award-winning recording of Dutilleux's violin concerto, L'Arbre des Songes, The Tree of Dreams, dedicated to the great violinist Isaac Stern, performed here by my guest today, Augustin Haderlich. Thank you.
you said how after the competition you got busy, which you did, and your repertoire is fairly wide. And if you just stick with solo repertoire with orchestra, I mean, you had to play, and you still do play your fair share of Mendelssohn's and Tchaikovsky's, and throw Brahms in there. And I know you love the Beethoven, but still throw Beethoven in there. But you're passionate about pieces like the Ligeti and things like that. So getting orchestras to program that, to have you come in as soloist to play not one of the war horses, it's a struggle. You have to work that they need to put people in the seats and all that kind of stuff. How's that going, though? I mean, here we are, 2018. I mean, how is it going in trying to get orchestras to program a little bit more adventurously with their soloist? I mean, they might pull the new piece to open the program with, and then you're on with the warhorse. But, I mean, how does that work? How's that give and take between you and the orchestras you perform with and book with?
Well, actually, that's gotten, I think, a lot. I think that the things have changed quite a bit in the last 10 years in that respect. But first of all, I would say that I actually love those warhorses so much, so I can't get enough of them. So when somebody asks me to play Mendelssohn, I'm always like, yeah, great. But there's a point, if I've especially been to a place a few times and I've done a number of different works, that then I might suggest, well, why don't we do something totally different next time, just to, you know, mix it up. And there's a point at which then people trust me a little more. The audience knows me a little more, right, and the orchestra knows me, and, you know, then I might take a bit more of a risk. So I think we have a responsibility, though, someone like me, I have a responsibility to choose pieces that really are going to be great. That if I show up with a piece and it then turns out not to be that great, then I've kind of squandered that chance. Then, you know, the next time the audience is less likely to give any music piece a chance. I think that's something that has happened sometimes, because, I mean, we've all heard some contemporary music that was bad, right? Mm-hmm. In any given period of time, a lot of music is not great. So I think that when it's something like Ligeti, this is a piece I believe in very strongly. And I know that, you know, it's incredibly difficult. So sometimes people have heard it and didn't like it, and it may not have been the best performance because it's so incredibly difficult to put together. It takes probably two or three times the amount of rehearsal that you would need for a Brahms concerto or something like that. But I think if it's played well, it is so exciting and different and also incredibly beautiful. And among Ligeti's works, maybe the most consonant and beautiful sounding. So I know that it's extremely successful, that it's just a great concerto. So it has sometimes, I've adjusted it in Seattle, and it was something that already 6 years ago I was talking to them about, you know, why don't we do the Ligeti concerto? And I kept bringing it up. You know, finally, now we did it. And the response was extremely positive. But I knew it would be, because, I mean, I believe that about this concerto. So I think that's important. There's a few other works like it. I like the Thomas Adas concerto, for example. Which I think is also...
Of the conductors I've had on over the years in this program, they sometimes say frequency with an orchestra will allow me to stretch the barriers. Yes. It's interesting to hear it from a soloist standpoint. Say, if I go back often enough and they trust me and they know they're going to buy the tickets because they want to hear me play. I mean, you mentioned Seattle. You recorded Due to You with Seattle. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's great. That's a fascinating way to look at it. And then, so good. That's all I can say. Good. I hope well, things progress.
You sometimes have to, when it's a piece that's less well known, it hasn't been around as long, and there's a bit of fear of, you know, contemporary music sometimes in the audience, then the way that it is presented makes a big difference. So what else is on the program? And actually, I've done this before, that I was recording Sibelius concerto and Thomas Adas concerto together, because I know that the audience will buy it for the Sibelius, but then they'll hear their Adas. You know, you kind of
have to
get people there.
Yeah. Well, I applaud you for that.
Here's my guest, Augustin Haderlich, as soloist in the violin concerto Concentric Paths by British composer Thomas Adas. This is the final movement, titled Rounds. The work is paired on the Avi label CD with the Sibelius Violin Concerto with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Hannu Lintu.
Last thing is just if you read reviews of your playing, and a lot of this comes out, there's a lot of these adjectives and descriptions of your playing, which I sort of boil down and read between the lines is just sort of music maturity in your playing, your approach to music. You get these comparisons that you're a throwback to the golden age and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, who are they talking about? Exactly. Let's be specific. But I think what plays into that and just your take on it is your approach to music. And it's not just flash, it's not just a career, you know, just something deeper going on there. And so, you know, as you mature into your career now and the decades you have left playing, I mean, how do you view your career going? I mean, you're doing what you're doing now. And you said, you know, you could give up the violin maybe in decades to come if you wanted to. You knew that, you know, there's another life. But I guess the question is, what do you see yourself in 5 years? I mean, 10 years. I know it's a tough question, but I mean, do you just see yourself as continuing to perform on the violin? Are there certain avenues and agendas you'd like to move towards with the violin to see more? I mean, you know, you've got a voice here, so.
Well, right now I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. So if it keeps going like this, it's great. It's been really, really exciting. And I get to play music that I love and I'm not getting tired of it. And I enjoy the variety very much that you were mentioning, that I don't play the same thing 10 times in a row, but that it's always changing. And that means that I'm excited to play it. And I think the performances are more exciting because it shows in my playing that I'm pretty thrilled to play these pieces. And this is what I've always... Basically, what I've always wanted to do is when I was little and I went to concerts and I looked at these violinists and I always wanted to be one of them, you know, on the stage there. So so it feels great. I can't really say exactly what I would do in 10 years. I mean, actually, sometimes I get asked to make a recital program 2 years from now and it's incredibly difficult because I actually don't know what I want to play then. And then you end up having to change it sometimes, you know. And I mean, 10 years is even harder. But I know that I think I will continue this and I'll probably be more, you know, projects that I will spend time, you know, with different things. I'll probably learn a lot of new works that I haven't played yet. And I'm constantly, you know, looking for the next Ligeti concerto, you know, to the next Ades concerto, for another work that speaks to me in that way where I think I have to play this and this is incredibly important.
And you're doing some projects which help others. I'm going to give the link on our website when I post this as a webcast, and I'll give it at the program here. You did a little animation of the Paganini, 17, right?
Yeah.
About cats, and any cat lover should watch it. But it's really well done, I'll credit the illustrator here too. That's a way to reach out to people who, you know, may not otherwise ever listen to a Paganini Capri.
Yeah,
so congratulations on that. It's very well done.
Thank you. Well, I had the idea a long time ago, actually, about 7 years ago. It all started, I was producing some videos and then I was thinking, well, how do I make something that does reach more people who are not already searching for those pieces for violin music? And I thought, maybe something with cats, because it might go viral. But also because this caprice, I think, imitates meows a little bit. It sounds a little like meowing. So that was exciting. I think that this is something that in America, musicians are quite aware of the need to keep having to recruit audience members. You know, in Europe, actually, sometimes people, you know, are relying a lot on the fact that it's, you know, it's government funded and there's a lot of tradition of attending concerts. But sometimes people actually don't know what to do now that the audience is aging and there's a lot of worry about what's going to happen. But a lot of stuff has already been in America. The problems have been there for 40 years, but actually it's been okay. So there's some people who are doing so much important work who are really in terms of, you know, outreach, going to schools and bringing a new audience. I think if everyone does a little bit, then it's going to be okay.
You started with something really catchy, which is cats on the internet. That'll get the cat lovers.
Okay.
I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests two quick questions. First is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, never had a chance to. First name that pops into your head. Don't think about it too long. You'll swamp.
I don't know. There's a lot of them.
When I first asked that, what was the first name?
Yes.
It could change 5 minutes from now, but...
Well, maybe Beethoven. Although, actually, from what I gather, he wasn't that pleasant to converse with, but it would be interesting.
Well, you have to write everything. Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. Of course, you're very busy doing what you do. But when you have to break away or respite or pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do when you have to pull yourself away?
Yeah. I love playing games and puzzles. And actually, whenever I'm home in New York, which is not so often, but I try to get together with some friends and we play board games. And especially games that are very strategic or, you know, puzzle-like, I've always been very fond of. Rubik's Cubes, that's another, you know, thing.
Sounds like a good time. Augustin Haderlich, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Violinist Augustin Haderlich. You can find out more about him at his website, Augustin, A-U-G-U-S-T-I-N, Haderlich, Haderlich.com. His latest release of the 24 Caprices for Solo Violin by Niccolo Paganini is on the Warner Classics label. Check it out at warnerclassics.com. The Cats video of the Caprice number 17, with my guest appearing in animated form, resembling Paganini a bit, and along with those said felines, is titled Fantasia dei Gatti, and was directed by Paul Glickman and animated by Tam King. I'll put a link to it on our website next to this webcast, but you can simply Google Cats, Paganini, and Haderlich, and it will pop up. And I'll leave you from that recording of the 24 Caprices on Warner Classics with the caprice that accompanies that video, the number 17 in E-flat, as performed by my guest today, Augustin Haderlich. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org. Thank you.